Hi, I'm Amanda Borchel-Dunn. Welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing.
Your update on what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world. Hello and welcome to the Times of Israel Daily Briefing. It's August 31st, 2021. I'm Raoul Woodliffe and I'm joined today by our health and science correspondent Nathan Jeffe and our environmental correspondent Sue Sirks. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Good morning.
Hello.
On today's show, summer holidays are over and school is set to restart tomorrow. We'll discuss the new COVID regulations allowing the opening to take place and how they're set to work. Israel yesterday passed 7,000 fatalities from the virus since the start of the pandemic last year. We'll look at the current rate of infection and ask how the vaccine booster is having an impact. Turning to the environment, we'll assess a new government report released yesterday, which claims Israel has much higher methane emissions than the world average. Why is it so high and what can be done? And finally, we'll look at how the new agricultural reform is set to impact both Israeli farmers and consumers. So Nathan, the two-month summer break in Israel comes to an end tomorrow, and it's been full of wondering by parents whether schools will come back on time or not. After much debate, it appears now that they will indeed be returning tomorrow on September the 1st. Tell us how the return to school will look this year.
Yeah, so it is going to be a little bit different. Parents are being asked today, the day before the return to school, to test their children for COVID at home. In a massive deployment of home coronavirus tests, relatively simple to perform. And this is all really kind of hinging on trust and solidarity, in the sense that parents are going to do this and are going to accurately report the results and not send their child to school if their child is infected. And the whole idea of this is basically to stop those asymptomatic cases, those cases where kids don't realise they're infected but actually can go around infecting other kids, to stop those people from turning up to school. And the hope is that by doing that, you can start the school year relatively COVID-free in classrooms.
And last year, there was, of course, a breakout following the return to schools. In addition to the tests that are being requested of parents to take of all their children, what steps are being taken by the government to prevent the next few weeks ballooning?
Yeah, so there is continuation of the wearing of masks in classrooms. Now, I suspect that that's going to be more strictly enforced than in the past. So children will be expected to keep their masks on during the school day, which is a burden for children, but will very much be expected. There will be attention to social distancing within schools to the degree that it's possible. When there are positive cases, there will be quarantining of children from that class. Possibly that will change to a program where children who are in contact will be tested on a regular basis instead of being strictly quarantined. We're still waiting to see this. And one of the more controversial aspects is that teachers will be expected to either be vaccinated or regularly tested for COVID, which is a source of some friction with the teachers' unions.
We know there's already some opposition to that, potentially within the government. Do you see the rollout of that plan working as the government wants?
I think that it will be accepted. I think there will be resistance from the teachers' union, but I think these steps will come together to give a good chance, possibly the best chance possible, of a smooth return to school. I think what we've seen here is some very real steps to try to build that trust between government and the public. So if we compare where we stand today to where we stood a year ago, we have this program of testing that is relying on trust and appealing to parents. They're not legally obliged to do these tests, but the expectation is that people will. What we've seen is real attempts also to communicate with parents, so not to leave things to the last minute. This time last year, everything was kind of very up in the air. People didn't know what was happening. There was constant changes to lockdown requirements. And what we see here is the government really trying to communicate and allow parents to plan, and saying to parents for the last few days, school will be restarting. This is what's happening. Try to understand what's happening now. So I think that's going to make kind of a big difference, and will allow this green pass for teachers thing to just kind of become one part of it and one piece that does get accepted.
Now, as I mentioned yesterday, Israel surpassed 7,000 deaths since the start of the pandemic, a grim reminder of the human toll wrought by the renewed onslaught onslaught of COVID-19. Tell us, Nathan, about the current situation of infection rates in Israel and how that's expected to impact moving forward.
So numbers are high. Positive case numbers are high at the moment. This is Israel's fourth wave. The experts seem to think that we are at or have reached the peak and case numbers will soon seriously reduce. However, it's very clear that we have things that are working against that. We have the return to school. If we're testing all these children on one day, obviously that will cause a spike in positive cases. We can expect that. Rosh Hashanah may cause a further spike in positive cases. Essentially, what we have is a race that's going on here. Infections versus injections. So the infections that are kind of very high from the Delta variant versus the struggle to reduce those infections by giving out these booster doses of the vaccine, which do seem to be working. So what we're really trying to do is to counteract the infections with the injections. And what the state is hoping, just over a week ago, I interviewed the coronavirus czar, and what the state is hoping is that basically the boosters are going to be able to stabilize these peaks that would come from the opening of school, come from Rosh Hashanah and that kind of thing. So we're going to see this wave actually start to wane. That's the hope.
And the boosters now have become the norm, with Israel implementing a system by which we'll need the boosters in order to receive the green pass that allows Israelis to enter certain public events and certain public spaces.
Yeah, I mean, this is true. But I mean, the surprise that people are kind of showing about this is a little bit strange, because if people remember when they got their first green pass, it was valid for a certain amount of time. And when we started talking about vaccines, we were talking about vaccines and saying, hey, we're probably going to need boosters. And what we've actually seen happen is just kind of, an interesting process by which Israel started giving the boosters. This became massive news around the world, and we've kind of reacted by acting a little bit surprised, or, this is something a little bit unexpected. But I think all along we expected our green passes to require some type of update, expected to need booster shots. And all we see now is that is happening. But what we do see is that the vaccines, and it should be stressed, despite everything, despite the challenges of the Delta variant, are still delivering good protection. If you go into a COVID ward, yes, you will see lots of people who are unvaccinated. But I do stress that if you look at the statistics, you are many, many, many more times vulnerable to becoming seriously sick with COVID if you are not vaccinated compared to if you are vaccinated. So despite everything, that is still the case.
Hello, I'm Ari Lam, the host of Good Faith Effort, the podcast where we show how the values and ideas of the Bible can illuminate the most important conversations in society. Want to hear a major music exec talk about the book of Genesis in hip-hop? Leading venture capitalists on how the book of Isaiah informs their work? Or an Oscar-winning producer reflect on how religion can save the American soul? Well, then subscribe to Good Faith Effort on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and listen in to inspiring conversations you won't hear anywhere else.
Now, Sue, from the green pass to green emissions, or perhaps less green emissions. Yesterday, the Environmental Protection Ministry put out a report showing that Israel's methane emissions are much higher than the world averages. Can you tell us a little bit about why Israel seems to have such high methane emissions and what can be done to bring those emissions down?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand that methane stays in the atmosphere for less time than carbon dioxide. But while it's there, it's 84 times stronger as a global warming gas. So it's very important to reduce it. The report actually shows that per capita we're turning out, well, there's a measure called carbon dioxide equivalent, which allows them to compare all gases. We're turning out per capita 1.3 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. We're actually talking about 2020 in the case of this report, which compares with 1.07 tons worldwide and 0.89 tons in the European Union. So what we're emitting is much higher than in Europe and in the world. Most of it is actually coming from landfill. We are very behind on dealing with our waste. 80% goes to landfill, very little recycling. This will be changed. There is a plan now within the Environment Ministry to completely overhaul the way that we do treat waste and to put the emphasis on recycling so that only 20% will go to landfill and not 80%. But I think that one of the interesting things is that this Environmental Protection Minister, Tamar Zandberg, is going to be putting far more of of a focus on methane emissions actually from the natural gas industry. She's even instructed her officials to stop calling it natural gas, but to call it drilled gas, because natural gas implies that it's something that's harmless.
It sounds wonderful, natural gas. It's natural, of course.
Exactly, but it is a fossil fuel. It is natural, but it is a fossil fuel. Today, the monitoring of methane only takes place on the gas processing platforms, and the people in the Energy Ministry are fond of saying, oh, emissions are negligible. But actually, no monitoring is done of the entire infrastructure. In other words, there can be leaks in the pipes from the wells to the production platform and from the production platform further into land. That's very, very difficult to do because all this stuff is underwater. But the Environment Ministry has said that they're going to look at broadening the requirements to monitor, and that will be extremely interesting.
Now, in addition to drilling for natural gas in the Mediterranean, this week we've seen a further oil spill from Syria that experts worry could spill deep into the Mediterranean, currently potentially washing up on Cyprus's shore. In February, we saw a large oil spill on Israel. How could the latest oil spill potentially affect the region and Israel?
Well, it's a relatively small oil spill, although all oil spills obviously are very damaging. This one has been floating towards the northern tip of Cyprus, so it's in the opposite direction from Israel. We recall that in February there was a massive oil spill in Israel where a ship that was offshore spilled oil. It was only discovered days later, and most of Israel's Mediterranean beaches were covered in tar. And in fact, tar is still washing up. We're already in August, and the teams are still working on clearing the tar from rock and rocky ledges in the north of Israel, and they're not expected to finish that until the end of the year. So these things really have long-lasting effects, and the effects are probably far more long-lasting than we can even see. And in fact, there was yet another leak this week in a pipe that is owned by the Europe-Asia pipeline company, Katsapa, which, as listeners may remember from previous podcasts or from articles, signed a deal with the United Arab Emirates to bring massive amounts of oil through Israel from Eilat to Ashkelon. This is Gulf oil, in a deal that really doesn't benefit Israelis as such. I mean, Israelis will not use this oil. The UAE will be using Israel as a land bridge to get their oil to markets in the southern Mediterranean. So there's been another leak in a Katsa pipe. Something like 12 acres of contaminated soil have already been cleared. The Environment Ministry has opened a criminal investigation into this leak, and it is one of many. You know, we have to remember that Katsa was responsible for the biggest environmental disaster in Israel's history, in Ivrona in the south, in a nature reserve in 2014, when there was a massive oil spill. And there have been many, many accidents. And Katsa is very, very secretive. It's based in the finance ministry. Nobody has a clue about the contents of the deal with the UAE. And there's massive pressure on the government to open up, to see what's in this deal and to consider what the environmental organizations say are massive dangers associated with this deal.
Now, finally, Sue, the government is moving ahead with its budget, and one key proponent of that budget is reform to the agricultural industry, which you've written about extensively this week. Tell us why the plan to bring down prices for fruits and vegetables for the Israeli consumer is being considered by some as a risk to the entire agricultural sector.
So the aim is, as you say, is to bring down prices, which have gone up substantially over the past decade. The government's plan is to deal with this by lowering import barriers. In other words, opening up the market and making the farmers compete directly with farmers from Europe and Turkey and other places. And in fact, last month we saw massive farmer protests out on the major junctions and out on the streets. Now, what I did was I discovered that the agriculture ministry itself actually puts out every week prices charged, the prices that are probably received by the farmers, that are charged by the smaller city stores, which is AMPM, corner shops, that kind of thing, and by the major supermarket chains. Every week these figures are put out. And if you look at the figures, you see that it's the retail sector that is putting up the prices. So, for example, in the week that I looked at, cherry tomatoes were being marked up by 212% in city stores and by 149% in the big supermarkets. and red peppers were being marked up by 191% in the small stores and 118% in the supermarkets. Now, the finance ministry says that they've looked at various studies, most of which are very, very old, which show that the supermarkets are making very small profits and that the farmers have to be more efficient and what have you. And so they've adopted a model that's used, that was introduced in the European Union, but over a far longer time period, to pay instead of tariffs, which are indirect payments and which can skew the market, or to give them direct payments. And so farmers are to be given 100 shekels per acre equivalent. But the economists point out that it's oranges and pears, because in Europe, much of the land is low quality pasture land, whereas in Israel, it's very intensively farmed vegetables and fruit. You don't really have pasture land in Israel, which means that it's nowhere near does it cover the output of farmers. So there are economists saying this could completely ruin the farming industry and cause farmers to go bust. Now, we already have, in terms of, you know, it is right that farming prices are high. We already have something like 650,000 families that suffer from food insecurity, which means that they can't put a nutritious meal together. Whether this is the right way to do it, by forcing the farmers to compete, and also on a slightly unlevel playing field, because, for example, water prices are very high here. Labour costs are quite high as well. And when you're competing with Turkey or Greece, it's not necessarily a fair comparison. But there is one more point that I would like to bring in, which I didn't have the space to bring into my article, which is that in Europe now, and in Britain post-Brexit, they are tying payments to farmers to environmental improvements, which might be water purification, it might be leaving a certain amount of land to go wild for biodiversity. And that is just completely absent from the proposals here. So the farmers are actually saying, we're not opposed to change, but don't put it through with a million other proposals in the Economic Arrangements Bill, which accompanies the state budget. Sit with us. Let's talk about this together.
And the state budget will be advancing in the coming weeks, potentially the first reading of the bill going through this week in the Knesset, and we'll, of course, be following here on the Daily Briefing. I want to thank you both, Nathan Jaffe and Sue Sirks, for joining me today.
Pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
And we'll be back tomorrow with more of what's important in Israel, the Middle East, and the Jewish world.
Hi, it's Sarah Tuttle-Singer from The Times of Israel. Come join our community and support fast and fair independent journalism. You can sign up with the link at the bottom of every single article on the site.
Thanks for listening to The Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. A special thanks to our producer, Raoul Whitliff. I'm Amanda Borshaldan.
You can find us daily wherever you get your podcasts.
And on our mothership, thetimesofisrael.com.